when you trim or shave, your beard grows much bigger. If you never touch your beard, it stays small. Generally. They don't.
Maybe this is a
Taliban. All right, good evening, everybody. And welcome. I'm so glad that you're all here tonight. So I'm so glad that you're all here tonight. Full class. There's more people coming. So this is the second class of Soul Quest. There are a few new people here tonight. So what we're going to do is we're going to give a quick recap of last week.
Not to be confused with Soul Train.
Not to be confused with Soul Train. That's correct. That's something different.
Yeah.
Oh, Bruce called me today. He said he's going to be sick. He's not going to be here.
He's going.
He is sick. I have an appointment with the flu. Then I called me today.
I'm calling you
today. I'm about to make an appointment.
You gotta watch it because karma will hit you and then you'll become sick.
Exactly. You gotta be careful. So I'm quickly going to go over the key points of last week. First of all, we started out with a diagram of sorts of the soul. And we discussed about the concept of a soul being something obviously not physical and very different than the body. We brought down an interesting reading from Maimonides, how he discusses everything in this world has its physical essence and then the program. And we compared that to, say, a computer. A computer is a piece of plastic, but it's got running within it currents of ones and zeros that determine what the computer does when you press a button, when you click the mouse, when you hit the keypad. So human, in essence, or every physical element of this world that we live in has those two elements as well. It has the physical design, or the physical particles, and then its design, or its sub-program that tells it what to do. And then we went a little into a concept that we discussed in previous classes about this soul being emanating from the essence of God himself. And we differentiated between an animal and a human, whereas when God created the animal, it was one entity. It was body and soul as one. When God created the human, it was a two-step process. Step number one, create a physical being. And then Genesis explains that the breath of life was infused within this creature called the human. Now this two-step process holds meaning for us because we're meant to uplift everything in this physical world and infuse it with meaning. And the only way we can do that is if we come from that very element. In order to uplift something, you have to go from the bottom, lift it up, and then bring it to a higher level. And that is what we are meant to do. And then we spoke about the journey of the soul. The soul was here way before its present existence, and it will be here way after its present existence. This is one leg of the journey. It's one step of the journey. And while we are here, and not an insignificant one, a very important one, because this leg of the journey enables us to interact with the physical world, give it meaning, thereby uplifting it. So it's a meaningful leg of the journey, but nevertheless, it's a small segment of a journey that began long ago and will continue. And every opportunity that we encounter in this lifetime, in this leg of the journey, is an opportunity to do good. It's an opportunity to transform something into the realm of positive. Ever more so if it's a challenging opportunity. If a challenge comes our way, we hereby have an interesting ability or a unique ability to take that challenge, transform it into something positive. So that's what we discussed last week. Today's course is going to talk about the creation of the soul. We're going to do an experiment. We're going to create a soul. I'm just kidding.
Thank God.
I'm surprised nobody looked at me like, what?
Thank God.
Don't do this at home.
That's the Frankenstein story.
That's the Frankenstein story, exactly. It's the only place. That's a good point.
What's that?
The only place you should do it.
So the soul has, just to recap, the soul has two elements. I'm just was reading the vital soul, which is like our mortal soul, and then the other one is not
animalistic soul.
The animalistic soul, and then there's the one that's, that lives
the godly soul. You can sit next to me. No, the board is this way.
Oh, no.
I did it on purpose that way. Not necessarily. We discussed it last week. It's a soul can be. I wouldn't use the term used. I'll tell you why. Well, unlike a vehicle, when you hear the word pre-owned, you're thinking, "Well, I only got a little more life out of this thing." A soul, when we just touched upon this last week, is in the process of continuous growth. Remember, it's an eternal element. It's not finite. It's infinite.
Yeah, what is it about the
That's next week's class.
It's always next week's class.
This week's class, we're going to touch about how it comes into being, how a soul is born, the process, growth, advancement, and fusion throughout life of the body and soul, the entity of the human. That's what we're going to discuss this week. The points we're going to cover are, first and foremost, that souls are born, quote unquote, to reach goals and accomplish a specific mission. And every single soul within the confines of its own body has a unique mission. Accomplishments during this mission become part of the eternal existence of this soul. So, in answering your question, if it's an eternal existence and it's continuously growing, so a used soul, in essence, is a better soul in a certain sense, because it's had previous experience and it's had the opportunity previously to grow. So you got a soul that's now going to grow even more. A certain element of the soul was created together with Adam. We're going to touch upon that in a later class.
And so, do souls get like merit or a very good person? Your soul gets to skip a few notches. And
I wouldn't say skip a few notches. It fulfills its purpose. And if you don't take the opportunity to fulfill its purpose, then it's deficient. A deficient soul needs to come back again. In a certain sense, yeah.
But they're born at the time of each individual person, and they're all born at different.
Exactly. So, if you remember last week, the reason why I didn't want to go into this is because it's a very complex, lengthy discussion. But just let me touch upon it for a second. Remember last week I discussed that there are five levels to the soul. Remember we said nefesh, ruach, neshama, chayi, yechidah. And we discussed how the lowest level may be the level that can even expire together with the body. That's the level that's similar to an animal, correct? Then you have the highest level, which is the very essence of God. Now, in between all these levels, in every single soul has a source that emanates from Adam. Because Adam was the first human being. So on a certain level, all souls were created simultaneously. But on a more complex level, they're born at different times and they accomplish different things. So for all practical purposes, 2,000 years into the process of the odyssey of a soul, it's very different than the soul next door because of its experience over those thousands of years. So the fact that it was born at the same time holds some significance, but in the now and here, very little significance. I hope that answers the question.
Part of the question was, are they all equal? And didn't some come from the brain of Adam and some came from the heel of Adam? So there would be different aspects of the soul.
But in a practical application, does it make a difference? In a practical application of a human being and his mission or her mission in life, the source of the soul is not as important as the accomplishment at this time and place. You can have the most lofty soul, but if its purpose is not realized, then it's for naught. However, you can have a less lofty soul from a lower level, say the heel, but if an individual takes that soul and makes the most of it, then he's accomplished a far more than a soul that... So what's more important is the here and now and how... There are different levels, absolutely.
And we influence the soul, and the soul depends on how well we accomplish our mission personally?
We influence the soul, and the soul is influenced by us, yes. Well, that's the same thing. The soul influences us, and we influence the soul. It's a two-way, and we're going to talk about. Let's get into the course, and we'll talk about it. Let's start with the introduction, page 17.
Where did you come from? Not just yesterday or the days before, but before you were born, was there nothing? It's hard to imagine not existing. Understanding your roots helps you understand who you are. And perhaps most importantly, who you can become. Join us for lesson 2 of Soul Quest, where we will discover the origins of the soul, how life begins, and how you become you. You gain your unique personality. We will also gain powerful insights into how to live life in line with your inner self.
So as I mentioned a minute ago, the points we will cover is, first and foremost, we're going to talk about how the soul is born, and the need for the soul to be born is in order to accomplish a specific mission. Accomplishments during this mission become part of the soul's eternal existence, point number 2. Point number 3, milestones in life are opportunities for realizing our goals. And this is, you'll notice, a reoccurring theme of our classes. Number 4, what happened before life, what happened after life, in other words, the journey of the soul before our existence and after our existence in a physical body, are important in understanding who we are. Because if we only look at the present and we don't look at the bigger picture, in essence, we don't have a full understanding of who we are. In order to have a complete picture and a full picture of who we are, it's important to know where we came from and where we're going. And ultimately, understanding this gives us a deeper dimension in life and more fulfillment. And it strengthens our resolves to complete our mission to its fullest. So, we're going to start with text 1.
The soul is part of God from above.
And this is something we touched upon last week. Now, after it emanates from God, what's the process of the soul actually coming into our physical body. And texts, Jewish texts, compare it to the birth of the physical body. Now let's for a moment look at the process of how a human is born. You start out with preconception. Before conception, a human is all potential. It's a potential creature, a potential human, a potential Einstein, a potential who knows what, but it's all in potential. The next step is a fertilized egg, and at that moment you have the process of the physical body starting to form. And then you have the fetus. At 3 months, a form begins to take place. And then you have, at 6 months, a perfectly formed human being with arms and legs and eyes and ears, mouth, nose, heart, everything. At 6 months, a human being in uterus is fully formed. It can even, at some point after 6 months, live outside of the womb, if necessary.
5 months, actually.
Well, without heroic efforts, at 6 months. It's without even heroic efforts. And then you have birth. But even a child at birth is still dependent on its parents. Actually, a human is the most dependent creature on planet Earth. There's absolutely no other creature in the world that can do nothing at birth. Only the human. And then a child becomes a young adult, reaches puberty, starts growing up, and they become adults, and we hope by that age they become independent. So this concept is also applied to the soul. The soul is also continuously going through a process. Stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, and stage 4 that we encounter in the human also applies to the soul. So let's look at text 2. And we're going to analyze a prayer that's actually recited every morning upon waking up. It's a short prayer, and within this prayer, interestingly enough, is depicted the steps of the soul and the process as it's born. So let's take a moment and go through text 2.
The soul that you have given within me is pure. You have created it, you have formed it, you have breathed it into me, and you preserve it within me.
So the soul starts out, if you look at the prayer, Elokai neshama shenasata bi, the soul that you have given within me is pure, starts out, the first paragraph is a reference to the possibility of the soul actually coming into being. It's a part of God Himself and very far from the concept of the human being or the human body. And in order for it to enter the body of a human, it must go through a process. And this process, interestingly enough, is compared to the creation of the world itself. Now we're going to go on a little tangent here. There's something called the Kabbalistic doctrine of the creation of the world. When the world was created, it was a process, a four-step process. There were actually four worlds created, four worlds of sorts, the Kabbalists talk about, in order for our physical realm to come into being. Because in the very beginning, all you had was the infinite light of God. And that light and energy is so powerful that the physical existence of our realm would not be able to exist in the presence of this great power. kind of like unbridled nuclear energy. It's got to be contained somehow in order for us to make use of it. So you have this incredible nuclear energy of sorts called the divine light. And in order for it to become useful in this physical plane, there had to be a process of constriction. And that process was accomplished through what's called the four-world chain. Let me use an analogy. We're going to go back to the PC, or the personal computer. You go to check your email, and you click on that little cute envelope icon. That's all you have to do. You click on it, send and receive, you get your mail. But below that icon, there's a form of code. And below that code, there's even more complex code. And below that complex code, there's even more complex code. And below that, we get to the very root code of any computer, which at its raw essence is circuitry. It's energy. Ones and zeros. One is off, zero is on. No, zero is on.
Zero
one
is off.
Zero is off, one is on. That's really what it is. So in its raw power, ones and zeros are useless. However, with different layers of complex code, one on top of the other, culminating in a cute little icon, it becomes useful. Now, we know nothing about everything that's going on below it. All we know is the cute icon. But we are cognizant. We may not be fully aware of the complexities of all the code below it, but we are cognizant that it's there. What's important to us ultimately is that we're able to click that icon and utilize the computer in a way that's helpful to us. So the same idea, analogy, would be applied to how the world was created. There's a lot of deep complexities of spiritual energy below the beautiful world that we see. We know it's there, but we may not be cognizant of every, or aware, or we may not be fully capable of understanding every level of that complex spiritual code, similar to complex computer code, except we know it's there. So these four levels, or four worlds, let's go to page 19 and table 2-1. Oh, look at that, see? Beautiful. Can anybody here understand binary code?
Yeah. Number? I can convert it to a decimal number.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Binary code?
I don't know code. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a computer programmer, but 0 is 0, and 1 is 1, and 10 is 2, and 11 is 3.
Right.
That I know.
So, looking at the board, we're going to talk about these four worlds. Again, the reason why we're discussing this is we're going to come back to the soul. Remember, we're talking about how this entity, this spiritual power, that's the very essence of God, is able to actually become part of us. And it can't happen instantaneously. There's a process. So, analogous to this process of the soul becoming part of our physical bodies, you have the creation of the world, and how God also went through a process of constriction, starting with a world called Atzilus, okay, and then going to, which literally means, Atzilus means nearness or one with God. The second world is called Bria, which means creation. This is the first awareness of something other than being one with God. And then the third level is Yitzira, which means formation. And this level takes ideas from the previous level, Beria, and makes them attainable to the lower realms. And then finally, you have the world of Asiya, which is our realm, and this is the world of action. It's our physical universe. And looking at this, we can now apply the same concept to the soul. And we can now understand that the soul takes a similar path in order to reach our physical realm. Because remember, the soul came from the same place that Atzilus emanated from. The world that we inhabit at some point started out as nothing, and it went through the process of creation. A soul at one point also was created and went through the process of creation. Good evening.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes.
Maybe semantics, I don't know, but the soul comes from God, but the soul is not God. Or is it?
It is part of God, yes.
Part of God. Okay. That's not God, because we all have a soul.
And we're all part of God.
Right. Well, yes.
We are.
Yeah. All right, so we're not...
You know, every Jewish mother thinks her son is God. She's
yeah.
pretty much right.
That's Jewish, right?
Exactly. Mother thought he was
when
God.
When his father's business, he lived it all till he was 30, and then father was a God.
Anyway, so we're going to go now to table number 2-1. And... Actually, now we're going to go to table number 2-2. And we're going to discuss the various levels of the soul, the five dimensions of the soul, and then we're going to take these five dimensions of the soul and put them, okay, we have, and we touched upon this last week, we have the lowest level, which is nefesh, action. This is the level that we share with all living creatures. And then we have one level above that, ruach, which is speech and emotion. Then you have neshama, which is representative of thought and mind. Then you have chaya, which is will. Then you have yechida, essence. The highest level is the level on which we are one with God Himself. So what we're going to do now is take the previous table, 2-1, and we're going to overlay it over 2-2. Okay, and we see how they are analogous. You have the pre-world state, then you have Atzilus, Bria, Yetzirah, and Asiya. So again, you have this, within the realm of spirituality, you always have this process of birth, and it's a process. Yeah, same word. Michael. A book. Huh? Oh, yeah, yeah. You didn't get one last week? I'm sorry. There you go. So before we go further, are there any questions? Is it understood? This concept. Okay. Good. So now we're going to go to text 3. So now that we understand that in order for the soul to come into this world, there's a process, let's now talk about this process. What happens? Soul is about to come into this world. It's about to make its grand entry. The red carpet has been laid out. What exactly happens?
He breathed into his nostrils the soul of life. It is written in the Zohar, he who blows, blows from within him, that is to say, from his inwardness and his innermost being. For it is of one's inward and innermost vitality that a person emits through blowing with force.
When talking about creation, when we look at Genesis, every single thing that was created came about as the utterance of God. If you recall the story of Genesis, and on the first day God said it should be light, and it wasn't. And on the second day God said it should, third day, except when it comes to the human being. God didn't say that the human being should come to life. God used a different terminology, and that is that he used the forceful term of he blew into the human the energy of life. Why the difference?
Because
So let's look on the board for a second. And here we have, as I just mentioned, we have the ten utterances: light and darkness, oceans and firmaments, sun, moon and stars, trees and vegetation, animal and birds, were all used with words and speech. However, when it came to the human, that's the exception. We used a much more potent or forceful terminology of God forcefully blowing into this human the breath of life. And the reason for this is because God was conveying his very essence, something from deep within. And he was creating a combination of the infinite and the finite. And in order to create this paradoxical creature of sorts, it had to be different than all other creatures. It was something different. And why is the soul, so the human soul, so different than all other beings and all other creatures? And the answer is because only the human soul is given a uniquely divine mission. And only the human is given the ability to bring the finite universe closer to the infinite strength or power or energy of God. Let's look at text 4.
The purpose for which this world was created is that God desired to have an abode in the lowest realm. For such was his will, that he finds it pleasurable when the negative is subjugated to holiness, and the darkness is transformed into holy light. This is in order that in the place of the darkness and negative that prevails throughout this world, the Ein Sof.
Ein Sof means the
light of God.
Yeah.
Will shine forth with greater strength and intensity, and with the superior quality of light that emerges from the darkness, than its radiance in the higher world.
So darkness here is a place where godliness and goodness is not obvious. So a place where goodness is not obvious becomes becomes necessary for us to transform that area where goodness is not present, to transform it into good. So let's now move on to the next section. Yeah. Where? Oh, base of Avia. Of the
does Ein Sof mean something else literally?
Literally means something else, yeah. It means without end. Ein Sof, no end. That's a reference to the strength. So what this is basically is giving us an understanding that the soul comes from a very high source, and it's thrown into a world that we live in, which is arguably not exactly the most spiritual place. Why? Why is this necessary? Why the perilous descent? Why does this precious creature called the soul need to go to this physical realm in order for it to be shaped and molded? And what's the purpose of all this? And the purpose, as we just read, is because it's necessary for the completion of the mission to transform what is not good, to transform where goodness and godliness is not prevalent or not obvious, to transform it into good. So the soul in essence is an undercover agent of sorts, and it's uniquely qualified to transform darkness into light and evil into good, because it has these two elements. It has the body and the soul. The human now is fused with these two opposing elements, and only because it has these two elements is it capable of making this transformation. We touched upon this last week. Any other creature, any other being, doesn't have this ability. Only the human. Because we have both godly elements and physical animalistic elements. Therefore, we can take the animalistic or the physical realm or elements that are not good or negative, and we can transform them into good. We can transform them into positive. So our mission ultimately and goals are accomplished little by little, bit by bit. This is not done overnight. It's not done in one instant. It's a process. So the soul first comes into this world through the process of constriction, as we mentioned before. Then over time, the soul kind of grows up. And at some point, or at every milestone in life, it's able to do a little more. And bit by bit, the soul is able to accomplish and move forward and transform the world into the physical realm into a more spiritual realm. So let's read from text 5.
It is imperative that every Jew know that he is an emissary of the Master of all. Our position, wherever he may be, of bringing into reality God's will and with an intention of creating the universe, namely to illuminate the world with the light of the Torah and divine service. This is done to perform practical rituals as planting in himself by chosen grace.
And in the words, so how do we accomplish this? Till now we've been discussing how it's critical and important to transform the world, to make it a better place, to make a difference, to fulfill your mission. All these taglines that we've been using until now, but now the question is, how do we actually do this? What are the tools that enable us to fulfill our mission? So let's go, we just touched upon it in text 5, and in text 6 we're going to get an idea of what tools are at our disposal and what enables us to actually accomplish this. And this is from Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, a 16th century mystic. Yes. And the founder of the Chabad, of the Hasidic movement, actually. And this is, and he writes in text 6 a little more about how we're able to accomplish this. Yeah.
As we go through this course, kind of go over briefly, maybe I'm the only person that may not understand, but what the hierarchy of sort of authority follows should be. In other words, you have rabbis giving their views on all this, and some of it comes from other interpretations that I see in my mind, and Tanakh. And then, I mean, ultimately going back to the Torah, so originally God wrote the Torah through Moses' hand, then it's been further interpreted and refined through the ages and applied and understood and further analyzed until we get to the points of reading in this book. Or what does this ultimately?
Well, ultimately, and we discussed this last year in our, what was the course last year? The I forgot the name of it, where we discussed the hierarchy. But ultimately, there is principles by which the Torah can be extrapolated or interpreted or understood. As long as these principles are adhered to. So even if somebody came about, say, 1,000 years ago, which is thousands of years after Moses, if he used the principles that Moses set into place, the principles of how we can interpret the Torah and how we can extrapolate and build on the Torah itself, then it's valid. If those principles are not adhered to, then it's invalid. So all the texts that we're reading range from the very Torah itself, 3,300 years ago, to the Zohar, whose original author was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, a second century scholar, to Maimonides, who lived 1,000 years ago, to the Baal Shem Tov, who lived 400 years ago, to some rabbis that are still alive today. But as long as the principles used to reach conclusions are the same ones that Moses instituted when the Torah was first taught to Joshua, then it's valid.
How do you determine? Do you analyze?
There are generally 13 principles. And we discussed it in that class last year. It's called the 13 principles by which the Torah can be understood.
So as we're reading it, we're sort of going through that straining process of your analysis from Torah to...
Not necessarily. We're jumping back and forth.
But the conclusions we're reading...
The conclusions we're reading are all valid understandings or valid ideas within the realm of Judaism and Torah, because these conclusions were reached by following a certain set of principles.
Okay. So at the end of the day, they
ultimately emanate from the Torah.
Ultimately
emanates from the Torah.
But each conclusion, a conclusion isn't what I mean, in the Talmud, they have many conclusions by virtue of the same principles.
Same principles and come to opposing conclusions, yeah. Then you have, you know, you have the concept of the majority. Majority rule. So, let's, did we read the text 6?
No.
Let's read text 6, and let's, these are the words of the Baal Shem Tov.
The soul's origin is a supernal pristine place. Afterwards, the soul descends through the progression of the world. You have created it, you have formed it, you have breathed it into me, until it descends below and becomes invested in a body and the physical world. At this point, the purpose is to unite and connect the level of the soul, the way it is below, with the source of the soul above. The way to achieve this is for the soul to fulfill its mission to refining the body, the animate soul and its portion in the world. Through this, one achieves the purpose of creation, transform this lowest realm into a dwelling place for God.
So the process, as the Baal Shem Tov clearly says, is, or the tools, is mitzvot, or good deeds. These are the tools that help us accomplish our mission. And these tools, a mitzvah, has three key components. Number one, a mitzvah refines the very body that does the mitzvah. It refines the animate soul. And number three, it refines one's surroundings, the world around him. Okay? Our world. Let me give you an example. Let's pick a mezuzah. Right? Mezuzah. It's the parchment that you put on your door. When you take your hand and you affix it on your door, it's your body that is doing this. So you've just refined your physical body. Your animate soul provides the energy necessary for your hand to move and put it up on the wall. So your animate soul now has also been part of this process and has been uplifted. And finally, having a mezuzah on your door refines your home, and your little portion of this world has been refined. So in essence, it's a all-encompassing act that enables us to transform in one small way ourselves and our surroundings.
Does every soul have the same potential to do mitzvahs, to fulfill their goals and their mission?
Absolutely. I'm going to tell you a very. In a few minutes, I'm going to give you a very. I'm going to relate an interesting story that drives home that concept. Absolutely, every single person. So now, the mitzvah, or this tool that enables us to accomplish our goals in life, gives us the ability to reframe moments in life and reveal their true essence. You're walking in a subway, and there's a person there with his hand out. That's a moment. The mitzvah of you reaching in, taking a quarter, and giving it to that person reframed that moment and revealed why that person was there and why you were there, and why maybe 5 minutes earlier your train was 5 minutes late, so you two should meet. So this tool, the mitzvah, enables us to reveals the true essence of moments in life. It also reveals the eternal component of your portion of the world, which is the expansion of your true self. And each and every mitzvah, each and every good deed, each and every moment that you use for a positive purpose becomes a form of self-definition. You're defining your true purpose. You're defining your true mission. And if a moment comes along and is not properly utilized or utilized negatively, this goes back to a question someone asked previously, I don't remember who, that also becomes part of the soul's experience. Except that becomes part of the soul experience that must then subsequently be cleansed. Because it was not connected with its mission, or maybe detrimental to its mission. So that subsequently needs to be removed. And ultimately, any permissible item or experience in this world can be utilized for a positive purpose, can move our mission in life and our goals from a spiritual standpoint further ahead.
I have a question. It's kind of a paradox, maybe. When Moses was leading the Jews out of Egypt, his soul, he was fulfilling his soul's mission, right? He wouldn't have that mission if there wasn't an opposing force. The Pharaoh, was his soul, you would say, is doing negative. But for Moses to fulfill his positive mission, that had to be. So couldn't you then say that Pharaoh was in a positive way fulfilling his mission? I mean, you see what I'm saying? The paradox?
The Talmud asks this question. It says, look, why was God punishing Pharaoh? Right? The Torah clearly says, God told Moses, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, and you're going to ask Pharaoh to let my people go, and I will harden his heart, I will not let them go. So he was doing what God asked of him, why is he punishing him? So the Talmud ultimately answers that God picks certain people by which to fulfill the dirty work in order that he can then punish them because he deserved it. The punishment was coming to him anyway because he was an evil person.
Mm-hmm.
So he used him as a tool to be the one to defy Moses and not let the people go, and ultimately he got punished as a result thereof.
But okay, so he wasn't doing positive, even though he was necessary as a tool for Moses to do positive.
It's necessary evil.
Yeah, but then Moses is, I mean, Pharaoh had a soul, you know, it had to be cleansed somehow.
You know what? And even though he was chosen for this, for the dirty work, so to say, even Pharaoh could have said, you know what? Not me. Choose someone else. Ultimately, there's free choice. And even if God chose you for something, you can decide to do otherwise, both good and bad. Right? Don't forget. God asks us to do good. Many times we choose to do otherwise. So just like God chooses somebody to do good and they do otherwise, if God chooses someone to do bad, they can also do otherwise. And interestingly enough, the Talmud speaks about one of the Roman generals that was sent to destroy Jerusalem. And the way the story goes, just very quickly, that as he's coming towards Jerusalem, he shoots an arrow to the east and to the west, and it veers off towards Jerusalem. To the north, it goes towards Jerusalem. Every which way he shoots an arrow, it's going towards Jerusalem. So he understood that this was, you know, predestined, that God wanted the Romans to come towards to destroy Jerusalem. And as he's marching with his centurions, he sees a little boy, a little Jewish boy, and he stops him. He asks him, what did you study in school today? So the little boy says, I studied in school that God will smite his own people by the hands of the wicked. I forgot the exact terminology. So this guy says, look, he turns to God and says, look, You want to punish your own people, that's your business, but I'm not going to be the one, he says. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And the Talmud says he converted to Judaism. They had to send someone else. He said, there's a guy who says, look, that's your, what you want to do is your business, but I'm not going to do it with my conscience doesn't allow me to do it.
So in other words, if you do something bad, you cannot blame God for telling you to do that.
Absolutely not. Take responsibility for yourself.
You can, but then it's an insanity play in you. you go to a psych ward instead of jail.
Exactly.
God told me to do it.
Yeah, it didn't work in Germany either.
No.
I was just following orders.
Right.
Okay, so before we do this learning activity, let's do text 7.
The Mishnah teaches that every Jew has a portion of the world to come. It is not stated in the future tense, rather in the present. He has his portion now. Each and every activity contains his very portion, which is hidden in the Genesis of activity.
So every soul has a particular portion of the world to elevate. And this portion contains the spiritual future waiting to be revealed. And through action, words, and even thought, we're able to reveal this hidden divine aspect. So our experience in this physical world is an opportunity to define ourselves in the highest spiritual dimensions. Very important point. Our experience in this physical world is an opportunity to define ourselves in the very highest spiritual dimensions. And we may not appreciate the external elements of any given mitzvah, but nevertheless, we do understand that eternity is being formed by doing a mitzvah. And we have to be cognizant of this unique mission. Now, someone asked before, if every single person has the same unique mission. So the answer to that is can be better understood in an interesting story. The story is told of a wealthy person and a wagon driver. And they both came to a city where it was Friday afternoon. They decided they're going to spend Shabbat in this city. So it was the custom of the wealthy man to dress in his finest clothing, go to the local synagogue, and invite all the poor people back to the inn and make a nice banquet for them. That was his custom every Friday night. So they come to the inn, he dresses himself in his finest Sabbath clothes, and on the way to shul, on the way to synagogue, he sees somebody's wagon is stuck in the mud. And he understood the Torah tells you that if you pass someone's wagon stuck in the mud, you have to stop and help. So this guy is in his best clothing, and he starts helping this guy with the wagon, but this was a stubborn wagon, and he's pulling and pushing, and his clothing is getting ripped and it's getting smattered with mud, but he's at it for 2 hours. Finally he successfully helps the guy push the wagon out of the mud. In the meantime, the wagon driver, right, his assistant had gone straight to the shul, to the synagogue, and he's waiting for his friend. He sees he doesn't come, so he decides he's going to invite all the people to his room. But of course, you know, he's got a couple of sardines and some stale bread, but so he invites all the poor people to his hotel room, and you know, they eat, I guess they were used to it, they eat a meager meal. As we say, after 120, when they both go up to the next world, and they're trying to analyze if they accomplished their life's missions, they come to this incident, and they tell the rich man, you wasted 2 hours by helping this wagon guy, because your wagon driver could have done it in 5 minutes. And they told the wagon driver, why are you inviting people to eat sardines with you? That's what your master should have been doing. He should have been inviting the poor people to the banquet. So here are two people that they had to, in essence, come back. The soul had to be sent back in order to rectify what they had done. It was something, they both did something positive, but obviously they didn't accomplish their specific goals or mission, or life's mission.
Wasn't it just
for
happenstance, though, that one guy went to grab some cash
by? He should have gone to the shul and called his wagon driver and told him, pal, go help that guy with the horse. I'll take these people to my banquet. That's what should have happened, right?
Well, but isn't everything predestined or something? I mean, doesn't God direct everything?
So the question then is, how do you determine what is your life's mission and what isn't? It's a difficult thing, and not always are we fully able to. But generally, Jewish texts refer to two things. First and foremost, if it's an opportunity that cannot be delegated to others. In other words, if your unique skills require you to do this and nobody else can, then probably this is yours, number one. Number two, if it's going too easy, chances are it's not yours. There has to be some kind of, you know, when you do good things in life, there's got to be a little resistance. If it's just too easy, then it's like asking a math professor to do a fifth grader's multiplication tables. If it's too easy, that means it's not his job, really. So we're now going to do learning activity number one. Let's look on the board for a moment. And Viktor Frankl, who was a famous psychoanalyst, writes that one who knows the why of his existence will be able to bear almost any how. So let's take a moment to identify your spiritual mission. Is there a mitzvah that you are passionate about? Is there any act of kindness that only you can do? And write this in your book. And if you're comfortable sharing it with us, I will ask you to do it. If you're not, that's fine as well.
Which part of the book is this? Which?
What page?
Yeah, when you write it.
Page 24. Anybody want to share with us?
I can. I mean, my brother and sister are less unfortunate than I am financially. So when there's some health problems or things like that, it's my mitzvah to be able to help them financially, to do some things that they would have to turn to charity for and might not be able to even get. So that's a mitzvah.
That's a towering mitzvah.
Yeah. So I feel good about that.
And it's only something that you can do, because it's your brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably anybody else wouldn't feel the same way about them like you do.
Right.
May not give it all, may give a lot less. May not give it wholeheartedly. So I think that kind of fits right into here, and you're obviously passionate about it.
Yeah. I'm proud and pleased that I can
help. That's good.
Can help them.
Maybe it's too obvious, but I think I'm the best person to raise my daughter.
Right. And can't delegate that. There's no mommy that'll take that over. Or won't take it over the way you can, or you could, or would, or should. That's good. Okay. Good examples.
I really find it a passion when I'm able to help other people with complex problems, especially when I'm able to use my legal skills to look at sort of the evil, arrogant men and women you come across in real estate and business things.
Which part do you like better, taking the evil guy down or helping them?
Both are equally satisfying. There's no doubt about it. I almost see myself sometimes like a superhero. I mean,
Superman!
Right, or my obligation to do that when I can. But I've never really pursued plans for it.
And obviously your skill set puts you in a unique position, enables you to do that.
Yeah, I've been fortunate. I've fought many battles and they've almost all come out in my favor. But I love the fights, the preparations, the leaving no stone unturned, and being underestimated. You know, mm-hmm. and then of course the final result is big. I help people in our apartment building. I help myself. I help friends with labor problems. Help my wife. You know, and you really learn. I go to the school to try to change things in public schools, and just all these things by reading the education code, and that affects my skills. To the point where I've often thought about going and becoming a plaintiff's attorney. I get such a rush.
That's good. Becoming a plaintiff's attorney. Okay, so I think these are great examples of taking a mitzvah and recognizing that you are uniquely capable to use this tool to make a difference, to change the world in a very powerful way. Think about it for a second. Your daughter and your interaction with her, powerful. The people who needed your help, the way you're able to enable them is unbelievable. Your brother and sister are now have the financial means to be healthy. These are very powerful, good examples, very powerful. And here you can clearly see how this unique mitzvah is a tool that enables you to fulfill your mission, make yourself a better person, refine yourself, refine your surroundings, the world around you, and revealing the inherent spirituality that is in these little opportunities that come your way. So now we're going to go to text 8a. So the final stage, the soul is about to enter the physical body. And before the soul... You're escaping. Something I said?
No, I just can't stay awake.
Oh, okay. We'll see you. The final stage, the soul is about to enter the physical body. And now there's kind of basic training. The soul has to cram, has to learn about what it should expect in this life it's about to enter, and it needs to know what its mission is and how it's going to attain its life's goals. So what happens? Let's look at text 8a.
Deliver the following discourse. It's the devil when it's inside its mother. A light burns above its head, and it looks and sees from one end of the world to the other. And it is said, let his lamp shine above my head, and by his light I walk through darkness.
Now let's go to text 8b.
Prior to birth, it is shown the entire creation within the context of divine purpose. The soul is shown that all that God created, he created for his glory, even though his glory is not apparent. Through the light of the candle, it is shown that there is no place in the world where this glory does not exist.
So, in the first reading, we read about a light burning over its head, and it sees from one end of the world to the other. The second one, we read about how it's taught about the world being created for God's glory. God's glory is synonymous with goodness and kindness. Right? God is about good. It's good.
This seems to relate to, there was one of these series of classes where we were talking about, one of the things we were talking about, when does the soul enter the body, and when it's in the fetus, we were talking
that
about
was a Talmud, right.
What the conclusion we came to was that the soul is above the body, it's above the head, it's not like part of it yet.
At that point. It's the same idea, yeah.
Yeah.
It has not entered yet. And then finally, text 9a. Regina? Regina? It's also taught the Torah from beginning to end. So here, we see that in order for the soul to enter the world, it's taught a bunch of things. It's given unique vision. It's given unique insights into the Torah, into its purpose, to enable it to actually accomplish. Let's look at text 9b. So the understanding behind this is that the blueprint of creation, in essence, was the Torah. There are two types of laws. You have laws that are a consequence of laws that are a consequence of life. Okay? The fact that human beings inhabit the same planet means that we must create laws of coexistence. We must prohibit killing, stealing, and things like that. And then there are laws that are the source of life. Spirituality behind laws that infuse us with meaning and purpose. So, if the Torah is a blueprint for the world, by teaching this fetus the entire Torah, in essence, he now, or she, is fully aware of all the intricate details in the spiritual composition of the world that it's about to enter into. Not just the laws that are consequences of life, like not to steal and not to kill and not to lie and so on and so forth, but more importantly, it's taught about the laws that are the source of life, the inspiration for life. That is what this child is now being taught.
What are the
laws about, for instance, the deeper understanding of why we celebrate the Shabbat. Why we, there's thousands of different complex laws around ritual, right? That are the mezuzah. The mezuzah is meant to inspire the tefillin. Things like that, the Shabbat candles. There's a lot of them.
But not every soul has an equal chance to do this stuff, because not everybody needs a pharaoh.
Well, the ability to reach a higher potential comes through challenge, but that's not the only way. Just the day-to-day opportunities, and we mentioned this earlier, the day-to-day opportunities that we encounter every single day of our life. Just getting up in the morning. Think about that for a second. You're a wife, you're a teacher, you're a mother, you're a daughter. Just getting up in the morning, right, is, with five screaming kids, it's a courageous act.
It does take courage.
No, this is for everybody. We're reading here Jewish texts, so often you'll have a reference to a Jewish person because these texts are Jewish, but this applies to all human beings equally. They're taught the spiritual underpinnings of the world that we live in. And spirituality is applicable to all people. Right? As Jews, our spiritual sources from the Torah. Right? People who are not Jewish also have spiritual source, right? From other elements, from other life experiences.
Well, you already answered the question. They all understand the Torah. They might not become Jewish when they're born, but they know the underpinnings of it.
I have a question. This is it's a contemporary actually issue. It's a very famous Jewish philanthropist in Los Angeles. I won't mention his name, but it'll be obvious. He's very involved in real estate and philanthropy, and he owns a sports team. And he's always giving money to Jewish causes, building gymnasiums for Jewish. discriminated against letting minorities live in his many apartment buildings around the city.
And made major disparaging comments about people. Right?
Should we play Jeopardy?
What I'm saying is, how would God see his soul?
I mean, many people are mixed bag. The man would say to me, those goddamn Jews, and then go to the cleaners, where the cleaning lady loved him and gave her extra money, and then he'd go to his nanny and help her family out. It's like, I could never reconcile the man that said those goddamn Jews to me, and yet
human beings are mixed bags. Every single one of us is a mixed bag. You know, we'll do one positive thing, and then a few minutes later we'll do something negative. It's the definition. I think we have to recognize the good that people do, and equally important is to recognize the bad that people do and try to point it out to them and try to get them to change.
It's
not contradictory, because within the human there are two opposing forces that are continuously battling it out. You have the animalistic soul that's always gravitating and trying to move the person towards instinct. And a human instinctively, just one more, a human instinctively is like an animal. It doesn't want to do good things. It's selfish. All it wants to do is look out for itself. It doesn't think about other people. Then you have an equally powerful force, that's the godly soul, that's trying to push the human in the opposite direction and say, hey, do the right thing. Overpower instinct. You're a human. You have intelligence. You can do that. So if you see that same person one moment giving someone charity, the next moment slashing someone's tires, when the moment he gave charity, okay, it was his godly soul that had managed to steer that person in that direction. When he started slashing his neighbor's tires, it was the animalistic soul, the instinct, right, that had overpowered him. Yes, Steve.
So are people basically good?
The Jewish tradition tells us that people are basically good, yes. We are predisposed towards good. And we're going to touch upon that a little in a moment, I believe, tonight also. The predisposition is more towards good than not.
The movie Crash, that perfectly illustrates someone's good. No one's simple. No one's good, all good, all bad.
Right. We're very complex creatures.
You see a guy doing just what, like he's molesting this black woman, and then he's saving someone else, putting his life on the line to save someone.
Was that that movie that was actually here in North Hollywood filmed? Was that that movie, Crash?
It was about three years ago. Anyway,
you're judged in every action. Again, because every single action is a standalone process of this. It becomes part of your soul's experience, and ultimately every single action is it's not that, you know, you can say, hey, I did I did X, Y, and Z good and X, Y, and Z bad, let them cancel each other out. It doesn't work that way. Each one is looked at individually.
I'm sure those German officers did a lot of nice things for their family. You know,
some of them were exemplary fathers. They took care of the German shepherds like there was this film I recently saw, The Boy in the Blue Pajamas. You saw that?
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy who took care of his family. You know, fascinating movie. If you didn't see it.
The fence every day.
Yeah, his kid. The two kids, yeah.
Okay. Can you get it on Netflix or something?
Yeah. You can get it on anywhere. So. Yeah.
I gotta say, whoever's in your house right now is a very brave person, because there's a one or another baby crying.
Yeah.
5 to 45 minutes.
Everything okay? Danny, everything okay in there? Oh,
okay. My daughter holding the baby, that's why you don't feel comfortable. when the kid's older. So where are we up to? Text 9b. So beyond atoms, beyond this soul is taught that beyond atoms, beyond quantum mechanics, the energy that ultimately allows for existence is the godliness. And the secret to this unique divine energy is found in the Torah. Therefore, the soul is taught the entire Torah so that it knows that it has the power to transform. And it knows that it has a unique mission to find this holiness wherever it may be, in every opportunity that life throws its way, and reveal it. And the guidebook for this, the book that gives him the ability to understand and know this, is the Torah. Now, obviously, we do not retain this information, okay? Because nobody is born knowing the entire Torah. But at some point, the soul was given that guide and was taught the entire thing. Because had that soul been born with the entire knowledge necessary to live a positive life, then there goes free choice. So in order to allow for free choice, no child can be born with all that knowledge. It must be gained and learned over time.
So it's like analogous to our soulful DNA, so to speak. You don't know every twist and turn, the helix, the DNA molecules, but they drive what you do.
Right, right.
So it's in you, it's part of your soul DNA, so to speak, even though you're not consciously aware of it.
Right. That's what we mentioned before, exactly. It's like the code below a computer's hood.
Yeah, okay.
Same idea. But ultimately, it leaves an imprint enabling us to recognize truth when we see it. So although you forget it, this soul nevertheless at one point was taught the truth and knows exactly what that unique divine energy that's found in this world and how he or she needs to reveal it. So when the soul encounters truth, because he had already been taught the truth, he will recognize it. Now we're going to talk about the pledge.
It does not emerge from there before it is made to take an oath. What is the nature of the oath that it is made to take? Be righteous and do not be wicked.
So the soul must verbally commit to this mission and to be righteous before it descends. Now an oath generally fills two purposes. For instance, an elected official takes an oath. A judge who's elected to the bench takes an oath. The oath fulfills two purposes. One, to focus a person on the mission that he is now given. Number two, it empowers the person to fulfill the mission properly. When a public officer or a judge ascends to the bench, it provides the strength to carry out the duties of office. There's something about that pledge. And on the same time, it reminds him that the mission must be adhered to. Power cannot be abused. Person is given incredible power when they attain office or when they attain the bench. So we must remind them not to abuse it. Similarly, the soul is also given incredible power. So the pledge, in essence, is meant to empower the soul and also remind the soul of its mission. And all of this becomes part of the subconscious memory of the soul. There's a story told of a Hasidic rabbi, his name was the Apter Rav. He lived in the mid-1800s. And he lived in a Hungarian village called Apt. And once he was sitting with his gabai, with his assistant, and a man comes frantically, comes running into his room, tells him, "I'm from the town next door, my wife has been in labor for 24 hours, and she has still not given birth. I need a blessing, I need a bracha." So the rabbi first puts his head in his hands, and he becomes very serious, and he starts meditating for a few minutes, and he tells the man, "You can go home now, and your wife will shortly give birth." By the time he comes home, his wife had already given birth. So his gabbai, his assistant, asks him what transpired there. So he says, "Look, I connected to the soul of this child about to be born and didn't want to come out." He said, "Look, you know, I've come from a very lofty place, I'm not interested in this." So I communicated to him, I told him, "Haven't you just been taught that you're also giving the strength to overcome any challenges that may come your way? You know, you were just taught that we're giving you the power to be able to overcome any challenge." So he said, "That's what the angel told me. But now that I'm hearing it from you, you're on the other end, I believe you." He said, "You know, the angel, he's on this end, who knows if he's telling, but you're on the other end, and you're telling me that that is the fact, that you have the ability to overpower any challenge, I'm willing to come out," and he comes out. So this was actually recorded in a book called, this gabbai writes, this assistant writes, that he decided he was going to follow this young child and see what happens. There's a town next door, and he kept tabs on him. He said that he saw that this child, at the age, went through incredible challenges in life. At the age of 3, his father died. At the age of 10, his mother died. About that same time, he was conscripted into the Tsar's army, because they had the cantonists. They would take Jewish boys, and the people of the, they would actually give a quota to the Jewish heads of a city and say, "You got to give us, say, 100 boys by this and this time for the Tsar's army." And they would first and foremost look for orphans. You have no mother and father, that's going to complain. So he was an orphan. So he was sent to the Tsar's army. And what they tried doing was 25 years service. And the idea was to get them to become Christian. That was what the Tsar's real intent was. And he said that he kept contact with this person over the years, and he sent them packages. He said that challenges that this guy went through to retain his Judaism was immense. And he said it even reached a point where at the end he said he wouldn't relent, and he was beaten, and he was killed by his superior officers for not relenting. He followed this child. Now you understand why he didn't want to come out? But ultimately, he persevered. He was given the power to overcome the challenges in life. So, let's now go to text 11 and 12. And before we read text 11, so right before entering this world and entering the body is when the deepest powers of divinity are revealed to the soul, because this is when he's going to need it, and this is when he'll need it most, as he's making the transformation from the spiritual world to the physical and to a real physical reality. Okay, let's go to text 11. It's my turn. We've come full circle.
Oh, okay.
Okay. As soon as the woman gives birth below, the soul is completed above and sent from its source to its body below.
And let's read text 12.
As long as the child does not get born, it is not a nefesh, an independent living entity.
So even before the child is born, at 9 months, the body is formed, it's whole, and there is some sort of spiritual energy there, except it's on a lower level. It's on a level of all inanimate objects, all animate creatures. And in essence, it's even dependent upon the soul, just like the physical body, up until its birth, the moment of birth, is physically dependent on its mother for sustenance. Its lungs still cannot breathe on its own. So too, it's still dependent on some level on the soul and the spiritual essence of its mother. Only upon birth does the defining soul, or the nefesh elokis, this very highest level, is finally fused with the body. And this process of fusion, of body and soul becoming one, starts at birth, but continues throughout life. It's a continuous process. It's a process of growth. Let's look at text 13.
The entry of the holy soul begins with the process of education in Torah and mitzvah performance as required by the sages. For males, it begins also through the mitzvah of milah, circumcision.
So, for a male, in essence, he reaches the first level at the age of 8 days. A female actually retains it at birth. This is one of what we discussed last week, how females are on a higher spiritual level than males, in essence, kind of born perfect, so to say. And as you can see on the board, it's a process. So say the Brit, 8 days, the boy gets his kind of first level of spirituality, the girl at birth. Then you have the age of 3. That's a milestone. Then you have, say, the bar and bat mitzvah, where children are told that now they are responsible for their own good deeds, and they cannot rely on good deeds of others. Now they're slowly growing. And then you have marriage, where you form a family and you start bringing other people into the world. More responsibility. The Mishnah actually gives different ages and states the accomplishment of every single age. At the age of 30, you should reach this, at the age of 40. So we see that in every single step, although we have little opportunities every day, combined, these opportunities lead us to one milestone, to another milestone, to another milestone, and through every single little opportunity, and on a greater level, at every milestone, the soul and the body become closer fused, and in essence, they're growing together. It's a growth process.
If a man is not circumcised, is he considered not Jewish or Jewish?
He's Jewish.
But is he part of the
covenant? It's a mitzvah like any other. Well, if Jews,
for example, in Russia were not circumcised,
so in conclusion, we discussed many, many things tonight. And the conclusion is that we discussed how the soul is born. We're going to go over the key points. The essence of the soul is its godliness, and this is something we discussed last week. This essence must undergo many stages and changes in order to fuse with the body, creating many layers within the soul. Souls are born in order to serve as divine operatives and complete a mission. Every soul has a unique mission and portion of the world to elevate. The soul is taught to the entire Torah and administered an oath to aid it in fulfilling its mission. Anything done as part of the divine mission becomes part of the soul's eternal existence. Life's milestones mark new stages in the unfolding of the mission and new opportunities to expand our true being. Next week we will discuss the journey to the next world after departure from the physical body. This week we discussed how soul comes in, right? Last week we discussed about the journey, and next week we discuss, hey, what happens next? Meet you there. I gotta run. I have a flight to catch.
Oh, wow.
But Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know you're running and, I've always sort of thought it was fairly arbitrary that, you know, birth, in 9 months of birth, and suddenly you get a neshama. Is it about the breath? Is it about being separated physically from the mother?
I don't understand.
What's the difference between a 9 month old fetus in utero and a baby having a birth? You know,
is the breath?
It's
the
breath.
It's the fusion of the highest level of the soul. There is a lower level of the soul found within a
right.
fusion. The highest level of the soul and the body coming together.
Okay.
How much is it? 50,
65, 75. This was 7 for Levi.
How big is the inflation?
Two carriers.